Hello and welcome back to CodeBytes, sponsored by Search 5.0. And today we're excited to welcome Rob Bowley to the show. Rob is a highly sought after technology leader who loves growing exceptional teams and building exceptional products. With an impressive track record in building and scaling tech functions across the likes of BBC, Masabi, and on a supermarket, Rob has now entered the world of a business owner where he supports startups within the Northwest and is very passionate about building the ecosystem around this region. I hope you enjoy this conversation. So Rob, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's great to meet you. Thanks very much. This is great to be here.
Perfect. I know that you're a busy man, Rob, so we appreciate you coming on board. Rob, we always like kicking things off, and if you can just give us an overview of your career today, that would be great.
Yeah, sure. Well, quite a long one now. I feel quite old. So how did I get into tech? I finished university just as the dot-com boom was in full flight in the late 90s, and I was fortunate enough that someone I knew wanted to start a website to connect village communities. So interestingly, I didn't do a computer sciences degree. So the opportunity just came. And from there, I worked at a couple of startups based down where I grew up around Southampton and learned to code in my spare time. And from that, I landed my first proper web developer gig at Lycos. Some people might remember Lycos. It was a search engine before Google came and swallowed them all up. And that was in London. So that was my first job in London. And it was so much fun. It had a really piratical, pioneering feel as no one knew what they were doing, basically. And the next significant moment for me from that was when I joined the BBC. And that was significant because I joined a team pioneering agile practices. And that particularly was a real light bulb moment that I never looked back on, basically. Quite a few years as a software engineer in various roles, but then my first leadership role I fell into basically when I joined a scale-up called 7digital, which did music. So it was MP3 downloads. It started as Europe's biggest MP3 store, but that quickly shifted actually with mobile phones coming out, and I mean smartphones, so the iPhone, into actually providing music streaming services for pretty much half of the world's mobile operators. But there I joined as a developer, but I was asked to take on the head of development role when the head of development left. And it was something I was a bit reluctant about, but realized I'd prefer if it was me doing it rather than someone else. So that was the big shift away from hands-on software engineering into leading teams. And shortly after that, I became VP technology, or effectively CTO for 7digital. And then I've been doing that ever since, basically. I joined another small startup from there and then another scale up. And then about 6 or 7 years ago now, moved to Manchester in the Northwest, went into some very large scale organizations. So the Co-op, where I was part of the team that formed Co-op Digital, which was pretty much like a startup for the first few years, bringing modern internet era ways of working and internet propositions into, you know, 175-year-old organization. And then from there moved to Money Supermarket as a technology director, and in both of those roles I was responsible for sort of 150-180 engineers. But now I've taken another shift, which is I'm really keen to go back and work with startups again and give back all of my experience in helping them with their technology strategies and providing them with an experienced CTO when it doesn't make sense to have one sort of full-time, which is known as a fractional CTO.
Brilliant. Wow, what a career to date, Rob, spearheading different exciting and well-known businesses. Obviously a global scale, but a startup at appeal, and it seems that you like the startup territory with the most recent move. And it's quite interesting, the fact that, you know, you were a self-taught coder, more or less, Rob, you know, and certainly what we get from guests is alternative routes, you know, within technology and outside of university. So, I mean, for you, I mean, was it just right place, what right time, or did you have a vision early on in your career about, you know, the pathway to get into technology via, you know, perhaps a traditional route, or how did the whole self-taught come about?
No, I think it was fortune more than anything else for me. You know, I was one of those people when I left university, I really didn't know what I wanted to do with myself. And I didn't have any huge ambition or clear understanding of where I wanted to go. And that's something I feel like every day now, I feel hugely privileged and humbled by the fact that you know, I've got the kind of role that I have. But also sort of back then, sort of 23 years ago, there was very traditional IT, and then there was the new world of the internet. So there really wasn't a path that you could follow. Nowadays, you know, there are boot camps, there are many avenues and approaches, and much more available online for you to learn how to do software engineering than there were, you know, 20 or so years ago.
Yeah, no, for sure. It's certainly that the market certainly changed and evolved, you know, throughout your career. And obviously, we're at a pretty good stage, but a pretty exciting stage, I think, going forward. Rob, I know you are a passionate coach and mentor as well. I mean, obviously, your latest venture is going to be assisting and working with the startup community. But I want to discuss the power of mentorship with yourself, Rob. I mean, how would you define a good mentor? And I'm keen to learn, did you have anybody perhaps in your career who was pinnacle with your success?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think it's difficult to define what a good mentor is in many senses. The fact it very much depends on the individual. So for me, when I've had mentors in the past or I've been mentoring people, often you've got to try a few to find out if you get the right connection. But ideally, the kind of mentor you're going to be looking for is obviously someone that's got the kind of experience that you're looking to grow in. But I think also is going to take a relatively deliberate approach. And these are just good practices, whether, you know, you're managing people in your team or you're doing mentoring somewhere else, which might come down to good practices about sort of coaching growth and development, which is having someone that's going to work with you to identify where you see your strengths and weaknesses, what your objectives are, setting yourself clear goals for how you get there, and then taking a quite deliberate approach every time you meet to work on those themes and identify how you're getting on and identifying things that you can take away and practice and learn, and then being able to really track that progress and see how it's getting on. And obviously then adjusting it as you go based on, you know, what's coming up in their work life or the challenges that they're having. But particularly also for the mentees, you want it to be a safe space. So the real benefit for the mentees is feeling like you've got someone you can go to ask all the stupid questions, be vulnerable, not be afraid to ask those kind of questions, and feel like they're going to be able to give you really good, clear guidance and coaching. And I think part of that as well is the kind of guidance is it can't be really directive, as in do this particular thing and do that particular thing. It's got to help you go on your journey. So for the mentee, it really is up to that mentee to really engage very well with it. It's not like someone's going to be able to give you everything on a plate to succeed.
Yeah, absolutely. It's about creating that safe space, first of all, but a space of autonomy and accountability, you know, more importantly. And I'm keen, Rob, I mean, obviously, you've kind of led big functions, you've had a good career to date so far. What's been your appetite to change into this sort of position for you? I mean, you mentioned, obviously, you want to go back to the startup, you know, giving back to the companies and the clients at that kind of scale. Mm-hmm. What's been the reasons behind that?
I think for me, apart from it possibly being a bit of a midlife crisis, is looking at the things that, you know, have given you the most joy in your career. And I love growing things. I've always been very involved in the tech community, both when I was down in London and also now that I'm up in the Northwest in Manchester. Particularly for me, the things that have given me the most satisfaction throughout my career are the people that I've supported along the way. And if I look back through my career, that those will be the things. It's those people often where you found that they were in the corner, unloved, you know, not really, you know, doing very well, and the potential that you managed to unlock, and then seeing where they are in their careers now. And it's a similar thing for startups, really. I think it is, for me, sort of particularly right now, having moved to the Northwest, I'm just super passionate about growing the ecosystem up here. And in Manchester, I mean, wow, it's just really exploded over the last sort of 6 or 7 years since I've been here. But, you know, a lot of that is into big established organizations, big organizations that have moved into Manchester. And I grew up in the Silicon Roundabout in London, which was where all the startups kind of incubated and grew there. And when I moved to Manchester sort of 6 or 7 years ago, there was a few, but not much, but it's really flourishing now. But what they've not had is huge amounts of people that have had the experience going through that startup ecosystem. And we're like, I've got a lot of that. And, you know, it's just really exciting to be in a position where I can be giving back in a way to help them grow and, you know, not have to go through some of the learnings that and the painful challenges that you might have that you could just avoid.
Yeah, no, for sure, Rob. I'm quite keen. I mean, if you were to reflect back in your career so far to date, what do you think has been the biggest challenge so far?
I think that probably the obvious answer, and you may get it a lot, is similar for most engineers, which is keeping up with the latest technology trends. It's all well and good hearing about them, but it's another thing knowing enough not to be dangerous. And that is an ongoing challenge for any engineer. I think probably otherwise the biggest challenge would have been moving into much larger organizations and having to have a real shift in the way you approach and engage things. Because in startups, you know, everybody knows each other. It's quite small. They come with their own challenges, but in larger organizations, you know, you can be working with some very experienced senior people that have worked at very large organizations and have a very demanding expectation. And so that stakeholder management and adjusting, I think particularly within that, when you're working with very senior leaders, is there, I mean, this is a sort of typical trope, but they're expecting solutions, not questions and not problems. And how you are really there as a senior leader is kind of, oh, right, actually, it's me. This is my job to tell you what we're going to do, not just raise the problems that we have. You know, I've done that a few times. I've made the mistakes and I've had some very frustrated people on the other side of the table or the Zoom call. And that is definitely a really important one and definitely a big challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. It's about taking that step up with senior leadership, going to that first position. Rob, you know, having that exposure in a large organization, it can somewhat be daunting, you know, for somebody kind of taking that next step up, presentation, being accountable, as you mentioned, bringing solutions to the table, not additional problems. What advice would you have for anybody perhaps at that stage in their career?
So stepping up into their first leadership position. Well, I think it would be get a mentor and get a coach. There's some really good books that can help. I think there's a really good one called The First 90 Days, which is all about how you set yourself up for success in the first 3 months of any engagement. But you've got to be looking out, finding out who your stakeholders are. You've got to be identifying your peer groups. Who can you go and speak to? And really do outreach into your network. Who do you know that's got a job like this that you can speak to that can offer you some advice? And really, I would always say as well, make sure that you're protecting some time for yourself every week to reflect on how you're doing. And don't be afraid to make mistakes, because you're going to. Those are those opportunities for you to learn. It's all about your resilience. And I think resilience is just another thing I'd say about a big challenge. Resilience isn't about having your shields up. It's all about how you respond. It's all about how you respond to adversity and difficult situations. And obviously you can be under a lot of pressure in those kind of situations, and it can be quite stressful. So you've got to work out your coping mechanisms for how you're going to deal with that.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're going to fail forward as well, yep. Rob, and I'll definitely plug the that book in the show notes as well. That sounds pretty good. In your perspective, Rob, obviously the world of technology that we're living in at the moment, it's evolving at quite a rapid rate. You know, you've mentioned about the pressure to kind of keep up with technology and latest cutting edge trends. But what would you feel the industry as a whole currently faces as a main challenge, and what would it take to address this?
Well, it's been the same one for a while, and whenever I go to community events or round tables, the same thing comes up, which is around the skills gap and plugging the skills gap. However, I don't see we have a skills gap as much as an experience gap. If you advertise an entry level or a junior engineering vacancy, you will get hundreds of applications. However, it continues to be the case that the vast majority of organizations only want experienced senior engineers. And even as much as over the last sort of 6 to 9 months, we've seen a bit of a shift with organizations downsizing, and you're seeing a lot of redundancies and other things happening. Everything I understand is that market for senior engineers is still pretty hot, and they're getting snapped up really quickly. And it's often not the case that organizations don't want to bring on junior engineers, it's that doing so is a significant investment. And for me personally, I don't see there's enough structural incentives for organizations to do so. There's only a few things really in place to support organizations for these kind of things. And the main one we have is the apprenticeship levy. However, this can only go towards any off-the-job training, so typically the cost of an apprenticeship scheme. And it doesn't support with any of the internal costs for organizations for the on-the-job training and support, which is significant, as typically an apprentice or someone coming in on entry-level role won't start becoming productive or you know, getting out more than you're getting in for probably a year at least. And that's still a problem for me. I think that there's a lot of local governments are now investing money into boot camps, which is great, which is making it easier for people to go onto boot camps. And we have the R&D tax credits, but you know, there's just feels like there's this gap of that incentive for organizations to bring on and train up people earlier in their careers. I've mentioned before that I'd quite like to see something a bit similar to the R&D tax credit scheme. So basically how that works, if an organization could evidence that they've been doing something new and innovative, you can claim back tax credits on your corporation tax. It's not perfect because it is quite a painful process to go through it, but it does feel something that or something else is what we really need to really get this working in the way that we really need to.
Yeah, so something quite similar to that sort of R&D rebate kind of model for people coming in perhaps at an earlier stage within their career. I think from our end, you know, I think there's lots of good stuff happening, you know, with alternative routes, apprenticeships, but it's all very much a little bit sporadic, Rob. You know, my account. And there could be good things happening, you know, next door in a different region that nobody here would know about. So how much do you feel it's down to a collective group to come together, like a collective sector and industry as a whole, rather than just dependent on perhaps, you know, a government or one or two particular businesses doing good things?
Well, there is quite a lot of that around already. I mean, in Manchester, for example, we have Manchester Digital. Again, in Manchester, I'm on the Manchester City Council Digital Advisory Board, where we often talk about these kind of things as well, which is on that advisory board, it's bringing together the educators, people from commercial organisations, you know, the various people around that kind of ecosystem that we do need to get together. So, you know, there's certainly a lot of stuff going on from where I'm sitting. I think the challenge, like you say, is how do you bring these things together so people have a clear understanding of how you go and solve the problem? And it's all well and good saying, well, you know, there's kind of just get the right people together and sort of set up those communities. There are tons of them. You know, there's loads of volunteer groups around, you know, coding clubs for people after work and things like that. I think for me, yeah, it comes down to this: how can we incentivize organizations better from a commercial perspective to be able to bring on the talent that's all there? I mean, it really is there, just kind of sitting and waiting. And the quality of folks available now is so much better. There's some really great boot camps. There's lots of ways for you to sort of take that first step, but you really need your first job. And also, particularly around this as well, is with the underrepresented groups we have. Typically my experience, let's say at Money Supermarket, I formed a new apprenticeship scheme there, and we brought on engineers in our London and Manchester offices. In all the cases there, the actual assessment days, it was just so diverse, you know, both from sort of ethnic background, from gender, from age, you know, absolutely everything. It would have been pretty much impossible to have chosen, you know, just from white males. And that was just completely based on the skills and aptitude of the people coming through. So, you know, significantly around this early stage is the thing that is going to solve getting better representation in our industry from those underrepresented groups.
Yeah, and as a direct response and result is drive innovation, and those sorts of companies will be thriving, Rob. And I think a lot of occasions it's perhaps just a shift in traditional mindset.
Yeah, it is. I think, particularly when you know, most of the organisations I've worked in, right, I've not worn a suit since I spent 6 months at a pensions company probably 25 years ago. I mean, there can still be a bit of a kind of bro culture, but you know, I haven't seen it for years. It will tend to be much more kind of more traditional organisations. So, you know, it certainly isn't the challenge now that it was. And this, I mean, part of the fact around, you know, really enjoying working with startups is because of the fresh thinking. You know, they don't have any of this kind of institutional baggage from larger organisations. But then I got to say, Money Supermarket just did an absolutely fantastic job on this kind of things. You know, there was no virtue signaling. It was genuine through and through. But also a lot of organizations, and particularly PLC organizations, are heavily incentivized. And, you know, the exec and the board members, you know, they have clear metrics on improving diversity. So they want to solve these problems, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Rob, on that subject, I think there was a couple of some really good schemes that you've done, you know, particularly within the Money Supermarket. I want to talk talent with you. How would you identify exceptional talent in the marketplace, and what key traits would you look for when hiring?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, as they all are. I wouldn't say I'm ever looking for exceptional talent. By they are by nature exceptional, and organizations can't scale by only hiring the top 2 or 3% of engineers. Unless you're somewhere like Google or OpenAI, I'm generally just looking for good. And I think the problem with a lot of recruitment processes is they kind of weed that out. You know, so many of them just focus on particular technical skills. You know, are you familiar with this particular JavaScript framework or something else? And don't really identify the key traits that I look for. Competence, aptitude, potential, drive. And as much as it might sound corny, team players, people that are collaborative and communicate well and have emotional maturity. And the key questions I always ask myself or my team are, am I excited by the candidate? And would they bring something new to the organization? So, yeah, it's an interesting question. And no, it's no organization can scale on exceptional. You've got to really be identifying people that kind of convey those kind of attributes through the recruitment process that you have. But then it's really about, once they've joined you in an organization, how well set up you are to really unlock their potential. You know, I've managed hundreds, if not thousands, of engineers through my career. And there are very few occasions, I would say, where I haven't been able to make a really significant difference. And often at these, you know, I've joined organizations and I saw that person in the corner, they complain a lot, they're difficult to work with. Getting the right approach to understand and empathize with some of the challenges they might be facing, more often than not, made a huge difference. And, you know, giving them real clarity about, you know, how they progress and how you're going to support them to do so and what good looks like and other things like that. And the wonderful thing, like I say, is just there've been quite a few people in my career. You know, I've gone in there and here's the rock star engineer over here that everybody thinks is fantastic. And here's that person in a corner that kind of people don't really have too much good to say about. And there's been quite a few occasions where it's completely flipped. And you know, this person over here has suddenly accelerated their career, had a massive step change, and off they've gone. And that rock star engineer, the organization has actually realized isn't as good as they think they are, and you know, gone the other way.
Yeah. And what do you think, in those particular situations, Rob, what do you think has been the switch in the likes of those engineers to go from there just to excel at perhaps a latter stage in their career rather than rockstar engineer?
It's all about the environment you provide for them. You know, providing them with a healthy environment, which you know, allows them to feel safe and comfortable to ask difficult questions, giving them really good guidance and direction on what good looks like. Like I say, so I'm a big fan of things like career frameworks and role responsibilities and having transparency around those kind of things, so you can clearly point to what good looks like and then support them on how you get there. And then often it's confidence. So often with it, it's just about giving them the opportunity to kind of build their confidence and really take control of their own career. And I think the difference is once they've kind of had that light bulb moment, where they might have been cynical, or you know, they're giving you all the reasons why they can't do something, they have that kind of and then they start doing it, and then they actually see the impact that it's having, then they're off to the races, right? And actually that time and investment you put into that person, really, they then start looking after themselves.
Mm-hmm. And you said about empathy there as well. And I think being empathetic and putting yourself in this person's shoes, perhaps who's in the corner, if you like, you know, I think that's a key skill, yeah. And very important to have, Rob, and obviously complement that with a career pathway. And I like the fact that you like people who excite you and who are innovative as well, because that says a lot about, I suppose, the kind of business as well. And to be able to sustain that by giving back to them and filling, you know, that intrinsic, you know, satisfaction, which some technologists look for. What would be your advice to any aspiring software engineer, Rob, in today's market?
Well, look, it's challenging times. Certainly for people at that kind of entry level, we're seeing a lot of organizations, the first thing they let go of are those junior engineers. But I would say don't give up. I think the abilities that you need as an engineer are going to become even more important. I would say firstly, don't just learn the tech. There's so much out there now, which makes it so much easier than when I first got into engineering, you know, to learn frameworks and practices. And it's a lot easier than it was when I was doing it. Don't just learn the tech, learn the good practices. It's often these things that you won't get from going on a Pluralsight course or, you know, doing something else which teaches you how to do React or something like that. But what do I mean by good practices? I think it's the things that are universal to whatever you're doing in software engineering. How to design and write good, clean, maintainable code. Code that you can easily change. How to write good automated tests. So unit testing, especially, and learning about things like test-driven development. Learning how to automate everything, basically. Your testing, your deployment, how you can configure your infrastructure. Yeah, like I say, these areas are often missed on boot camps and even university degrees. I mean, university degrees, just for the way that the syllabuses are developed, can take years before the good practices catch up. And even then, they tend to focus much more on the technical side. I mean, they are getting better. Mm-hmm. But it's the stuff that most good employers are looking for. And within that as well, it's, when I talk about the good practices, it does come into those ways of working as well, which, I mean, it's hard to do so much when, you know, before you've got that first job, thinking about things like agile software development and those kind of ways of working into those good practices. It's kind of, I mean, agile software development, I mean, well, software development, it just seems to be all encompassing when people talk about agile these days, but it's making small changes that you can easily test and release. And that's where all this automation comes in, and those good practices around having code that you can change. I would also say more recently that AI is your friend. I think we're way off engineers being replaced by robots, if ever. But things like ChatGPT are a massive boost for accelerating your learning. I mean, I'm using it pretty much every day. It's like search engines were supposed to be. It's a real accelerator. And it really does give you that kind of very quick launch towards being able to do things and learn things in a way that you know, only a few months ago was much harder. And I think something like ChatGPT-4, I mean, I'm sure there's going to be loads of other stuff coming around now. You've got GitHub Copilot. There's something called Replit, which is a really great AI service for building software applications. But ChatGPT-4, I think it costs something like $20 a month. You get the ChatGPT 3.5 and it's free, but it's like 100 times better ChatGPT-4. So for me, that $20 a month is more than worth it. So if you can afford it, I would recommend looking at it.
Yeah, and I'm glad you said that actually, because a lot of people would think AI, yeah, it's there, it's fearful. I'm going to perhaps not have a job in the not so distant future. But it's totally the opposite. It's just embracing it as a help and as an extension of you, basically. So it's using it for you, not against you, Rob. So great insight and great advice. And I suppose on to yourself, I mean, what does the future hold then for you and your new venture?
Yeah, well, it's quite exciting, really, and quite scary, because I've just started on this journey only a few weeks ago, really. But you know, like I say, it's something I've been really wanting to do for a while, and you know, I've taken the leap. So basically, what I'm doing now is working with startups and scale ups in what's known as a fractional fashion. So it's fractional CTO. But the idea is I can go and work with them and they can get the experience from someone that's been doing my role for as long as I have, but without having to bring on a full-time experienced CTO. And I've been working with some absolutely fabulous startups over the last few weeks doing that. And I'm really enjoying it. I've literally just launched this business, but you know, I've already got a couple of clients, which is really exciting. And yeah, I look forward to doing it more. I'm particularly passionate about doing so in the Northwest, so across Leeds, Liverpool, and Manchester, and growing the ecosystem up here. But you know, I'm obviously with our new post-pandemic world, so much is possible remote as well. So I'm happy to take clients from elsewhere as well. You can find out more on the website I've got, which is called pragmaticpartners.co.uk, or you can find me on LinkedIn or Twitter, but I'm sure you'll share the links to all of that with the podcast.
Yeah, I'll plug the show notes, Robin. For those that don't follow you, I think you're brilliant on LinkedIn. You're very out there, you're active, and yeah, we'll plug those post show notes, Rob. Rob, this has been an absolutely brilliant conversation. So thank you for your time.
Well, thank you. It's been really enjoyable.
Super, Rob. All the best for your new venture.